What I'm going to do is give you a flavour of the sort of stuff that's been going on both in Atlas and CMS. I'll say some comments about detector issues, mainly about calibration. And then I'll say something about modelling, which is important, but not perhaps as important as some people think it is. Then I'll talk about inclusive searches, which I hope won't be searches, but will discoveries. I'll pick out a few exclusive final states. I'll have something to say about this. Most important are the references. So all the CMS plots that I'm showing are from the CMS TDR, which is published in JFISG. I've missed the year off, but it's last year. The Atlas plots that I'm showing are from the Atlas ongoing process, which will eventually, we hope, produce some large document of over 1,000 pages. This thing won't appear in a journal. There's no journal with it. It's too long. But most of the studies in there are more careful and detailed versions of what's in the Atlas TDR from 1999. There are a few things that are new, but there's not a lot which is enormously new. This work that I'll talk about today, and which is covered in the CMS TDR, is aimed primarily at early data, not what you might do ultimately. So you won't see any plots about what you might do with 100 inverse femtomans. It's too far off at this point. All the plots I'll show are at 14 TeV, as Leandro said on Monday. This year's run will be at about 10 TeV. Next year we'll be at the full energy. But I'm not going to have anything to say about 14 TV. And all I can do in such a talk as this length is to give you a flavour of what's going on and perhaps whet your appetite to go and read one of these more longer documents. So what this should be, perhaps, is not a talk on supersymmetry, but a talk on top. And in fact, probably there should have been a talk on top. Because top physics at the LHC is an ideal benchmark for understanding the measurements that you'll do with supersymmetry. Now, why is that? Well, the physics of the top quark is quite well known. Yes, there could be decays to charged Higgses, but the branching ratios have to be relatively small, although they've been seen at the Tevatron. So the properties of the top itself are very well known. But the simulation of it at the LHC, both theoretical and experimental, and the detector performance is currently unvalidated because we haven't got any events yet. So an ideal situation is to start looking for something that you know what you're looking for. So when you see something that's crazy, you know the detector's not working or there's something wrong with your interpretation, not that you've discovered some pink elephant. So Top and Susie have many things in common. They all involve looking for basically a broad, similar range of objects. Isolated and non-isolated leptons, in the case of Top from the W, in the case of Susie perhaps from a cascade Susie decay, missing ET from neutrinos in one case and LSPs in the other. Large numbers of jets, which enables you to deal with the issues of modeling QCD, large numbers of well-separated jets. B jets from the direct decay of the top or from some sparticle. Hadronic tau decays, which are relevant in the top and very relevant for SUSY. The cross section, the mass and the decays are all quite well understood from the Tevatron. So if you were able to do an analysis and extract some properties of the top, it enables you to validate the understanding of your detector. Now there can be other features in supersymmetry like long-lived particles, cannonballs as I call them. And other odd-bod features, but those can come later after you've understood the basics of what's going on. So this isn't a talk about top, but probably should have been. And this measurement of top is what I call part of the strategy to rediscover the standard model, which is what will happen first. Initially, with this year's data, we don't know how much data we're going to get. But initially, we measure the properties of the Ws, look at W plus multi-jets, which of course is a standard thing that's sitting under the top. So what are the relevant detector issues for supersymmetry? Well, I've basically said this already. You want to decay, observe all particles that come from the decays of some supersymmetric particles, which means quarks and gluons. It's very important to be able to identify B jets as opposed to light quark jets, since it's possible in supersymmetric theories that the spottom and the stop might be the lightest quarks and therefore they might be the most abundantly produced. And in any case, even if they're not, you'll want to make independent measurements to try to disentangle the mass spectrum. You want to measure the stable electrons here, mu. You want to measure the unstable electron that we all know about, which is the tau, and that could be very important in certain regions of Suzy parameter space, where you could have the situation where a complicated cascade decays all end up in the tau, and very little ends up in EMU. There's no reason to expect EMU universality, EMU tau universality, or even EMU universality for that matter. So the electronic tau decays are not very useful because you don't know where the electron came from. You don't know whether it came from a tau or it came from some other direct decay or it was directly produced. So that forces you to look at hadronic tau decays, which are not exactly trivial. In addition, you will have missing energy from stable or quasi-stable LSPs in supersymmetric theory, and you might have cannonballs, either heavy muon-like objects or things that sign charge flip in the, as they pass through a collimator. So as far as the performance of the two detectors are concerned, Atlas and CMS look quite different, and their technology choices are indeed quite different. That's probably a good thing, because it's unlikely they'll have the same problems. If somebody's technology has a problem, it's unlikely that the other experiment will have the same problem. But the performance of Atlas and CMS for this and other new physics is broadly similar. So in a talk like this, I can flash Atlas talks and CMS talks, and you don't need to really know whether it's made by Atlas or made by CMS. The way that I like to put this is that the relative intelligence and power of the physicists is much more important than the relative differences between the two experiments.
Are you
going to comment on that before? No. So, a few comments on the detectors. I point you to back to Leandro's talk from Monday about the status of Atlas, status of CMS and the LHC. I'm not going to say anything. However, I would like to make a personal remark, which Leandro sort of said. I think it's almost a miracle that on this time scale we got all of Atlas essentially into the pit, closed up and ready to go. And I think if you ask the people on the experiment a year ago whether they thought that was possible, most people would have said no. So I think it really is a sort of a miracle. And of course the next step is to make sure it actually works, which we will do this year, and that will be the main focus of the 2008 data. Some of it already works, because it's been taking cosmics, both Atlas and CMS have been taking cosmics for an extended period of time. Certainly pieces of the detector have been taking cosmics for more than 2 years in some cases. And the detector as a whole, at least Atlas, we haven't yet taken cosmics for the entire detector. It's close. Okay, so I'll skip through the pictures of the experiment. Okay, so now let me move on to talk about some comments about supersymmetric models. Now the problem, giving this sort of talk, will rapidly go away. The problem with this talk is there's always somebody who's got a favourite model and you haven't looked at their favourite model and they get rather agitated. The other problem that you have is that giving this sort of talk, you have to give an overview of where you think you will be after some time in the future. It's easier now, I'm not talking about 100 inverse femtomiles, but there's still an issue. And it's important to remember that the data doesn't all come in one big bang, it dribbles out a little bit at a time. And as it dribbles out, large swaths of parameter space and huge numbers of models start dropping like flies, and we don't need to worry about simulating those anymore, or we don't need to worry about making any more plots. So as soon as you start to get data, the landscape simplifies rapidly. The options start to disappear, and that makes it much easier to give this sort of a talk. If I were giving this talk this time next year with the benefit of the 08-09 data, 08 data, I might be able to throw out some of the plots I've already got as being already ruled out. So it will become much easier when you have data. It's impossible to do all detailed studies in all cases, so what tends to happen is that people tend to do very detailed analyses of a few cases and then look at the differences in other cases and try to extrapolate. So that means that a model is needed for simulation. Now, large numbers of models have been looked at, but most of them have not been looked at in gory detail. And whether you like it or not, the supergravity model is the one that's been studied the most for several reasons. It's extremely well defined and it's got small numbers of parameters. That's always a good thing, because there's less things to be twiddled with. You must be aware of the limitations of doing such an analysis. It turns out that when one looks at more complicated models, it's generally true that the Sugra model is in some sense the hardest thing to find. Now, of course, you can always point to a corner of parameter space in some other model where it's easier. But other models tend to have characteristic features which are not present in Sugra models. So there's two, and when LHC simulations are done in this supergravity model, we don't worry about constraints which might quote-unquote exclude that corner of parameter space. As Xerxes said on Monday, we don't normally worry about dark matter constraints, because after all, if the LSP has a lifetime of minutes, we wouldn't notice in the LHC, but it's a dark matter candidate. So, and we tend not to worry also about constraints from G-2 and things like that. Before going on and showing any more plots, I'll make a couple of general comments of the most difficult cases. The most difficult cases are models with small mass gaps, and I've carefully not defined the word small. 10 GeV is not a small mass gap. Whether half an MeV is a small mass gap, but 10 GeV is not a small mass gap. And our parity violation, where the LSP decays entirely to jets, because you lose the missing ET signature, and the dominant final state is a whole bag of jets. In fact, in that case, it isn't so bad, but you would probably do searches in electronic channels, not in pure QCD. So here's the spectrum, just to remind you, and I've put at the bottom, which enables you to sort of normalize some of the plots I'll show, the relationship between the squawk and gluino and selectron masses, and the two fundamental parameters, M1/2 and M0, of the Sugra model, so that when I wave plots, you can sort of see what's going on. Okay. So, a large number of benchmark points were picked both by Atlas and CMS, not the same, because they wanted to stress different things. So what this parameter space shows, is there a pointer? Yes. These two parameters, M0 and M1/2, you can tell whether it's a theory plot or an experimentalist plot, because theory plots have M1/2 on this axis and M0 on this axis, and experimental plots are always this way round. Okay, so it's easy to tell who made the plot. So what they've shown on here, there's a bunch of lines and things shown, which are not very easy to read. Here's the value of the Higgs mass in this model. Again, we're not going to worry too much about the Higgs constraint, because you can get rid of it by twiddling small numbers of parameters. These are the mass cases that they chose. And again, just to normalize you, most of the points that they talked about are down here. They're relatively low masses. Remember that this one corresponds to a gluino mass of just above a TeV. Use the 2.7 rule from the previous thing. This corresponds to a very heavy case with a small cross-section. Likewise, this thing over here. So there's a lot of study goes on here, because here you have plenty of event rate and low luminosity, which is what we're talking about having in the next couple of years. And you can hope to do detailed measurements of something from which you might learn something more detailed, rather than seeing three events and scratching your head about it for 3 years. Okay. Here are the Atlas benchmarks. And since Atlas, this is the Sugra cases again. And you can see the sort of masses. This is the gluino mass. 830, 850, 700, 850. So the masses of order of TeV. And Atlas also did a few cases with non-Sugra. So this is the gauge mediated thing with various parameters, and this is the cannonballs stable hadrons. So just to remind you what the cross sections are at the LHC. This is a cross section for direct production. It's not the rates coming through cascade decays, which often tend to dominate. So as people are all fully aware, the LHC is essentially a quark and gluon machine. So that means that the coloured objects have the largest cross sections up here, the quarks and gluinos. And the electroweak objects have the smaller rates down here, although it's worth pointing out that in a large selection of models, the dominant production rate for these electroweak objects, like the partners of the W and Z, or the neutrinos down here, or the selectrons here, come not from direct production, i.e. this rate, but from cascade decays down from this thing. And unless the branching ratio is very small, that will tend to dominate the direct production. Now, of course, ultimately you'd want to extract the direct reduction of these things, because you would want to use that to measure coupling constants through rate measurements. That's hard. It's not hard in the long term. It's very hard initially when you don't really know what's going on. I'll have a comment on that at the end. So the important thing about is to determine, first of all, what are the characteristic decays? So what are the things you should always be looking for that are likely always to be there? Now, of course, somebody always sticks up their hand and says, well, it's not there in my model. Well, go away. Come back when I've deleted all this lot, and then we can argue about your model. Okay, so you have a heavy object which decays to the particles of the standard model. So you have leptons and jets almost everywhere in this parameter space. And then there are other characteristic decays which come from the cascade. As I said to you, that squawk and gluino decays tend to dominate. They decay down to the partners of the electroweak gauge bosons, which tend to be lighter in almost all models. And then there is a cascade decay inside there, and then it's convenient to split it up into three characteristic regions, where you can think of this as the partner of the W, so it has a relatively strong coupling to left-handed squawks. So you get left-handed squawk decaying into this character, which can then either decay into a Higgs boson, an LSP, or to a dielectron pair, an LSP, or a Z in an LSP. This, of course, is a special case of this one. The only difference is here, all I've got is a narrow resonance, whereas here I'll have a continuum. And if you stare at this plot, you'll see that they've labelled this plot, CMS labelled this plot. Actually, the thing that says it's a CMS plot's disappeared. But anyway, they've labelled it by the relevant branching ratio. So here's a line. This region down here is the region where this branching ratio for this particle is bigger than 50%. So you should expect, therefore, if you're inside that region of parameter space, as well as looking for jets and missing energy, it's probably a good thing to do to start looking for Higgs bosons. Maybe you shall discover the Higgs this way and not the way that Leandro showed you on Monday. That's not necessarily a joke, actually, because many of the processes that Leandro showed you are very demanding of luminosity, because the Higgs has a low production cross-section. And then there are other regions of parameter space up here. Where am I pointing? Here's where the Z thing is at. That is 50%. And so up here in this corner, you're in the situation where this thing tends to dominate. So let me make a few comments and remarks about simulation. You better correctly model the detector response. Now, of course, yes, yet we don't know what that is, because we haven't got any data. So when we get some data, the simulation will be adjusted to reflect what the detector response actually looks like. At the moment, we have to do the best we can. And most of the plots I use some full Jeyonc-based simulation. Old plots from 10 years ago often use parameterized response. You can't do this full Jeyonc-based simulation for huge numbers of parameters, but you can extrapolate and use it to validate a parameterized response. Now, before you can claim any signal, you have to measure and understand the backgrounds. All right now, the only tool we have for predicting and estimating backgrounds is Monte Carlo. Once we have data, we will use the data to validate the Monte Carlo in the regions where we don't expect any signal. I'll give you an example in a minute. And this is back to what I said at the beginning about this should be a talk on top. Because a careful measurement of the top at the LHC can be used both to validate the Monte Carlos and to validate the simulation. Is the detector responding? Is our simulation responding the same way that the real detector is responding? And in some cases, you will not have enough confidence to believe the Monte Carlo. So there are certain backgrounds where I will never be able to calculate it from a Monte Carlo. And what I will do is use the data itself, extrapolate from one region to another. Peaks and edges are harder to fake than general excesses of numbers. Be very careful when somebody says they've done a counting experiment and it's a factor of 1.3. I'd be a bit skeptical, at least certainly initially. CMS studies that I will show you use a combination of Pythia misspelled and COMPEP to deal with the multi-jet final states. Atlas uses ALPGEN primarily to deal with U and Z plus multi-jet final states in the hope that that gives you a better representation of the final state with a lepton and lots of widely separated jets. Notice I said hope, because it's not yet validated against data. And we use MC at NLO for the top. And I'm now going to show you some simple examples and some trivial, relatively trivial comments on backgrounds. So, missing ET, where do you get missing ET from? Well, you get missing ET from a broken detector. Big hole that's not responding. Mismeasured jets are the dominant source of missing ET. Now, if missing ET is arising from a mismeasured jet, then the missing ET tool vector will point in the transverse plane in the direction of one of the jets. So you should look for a correlation between missing ET and a jet direction. And if it's close, you should be skeptical, because you should be worried that, oh, I've just mismeasured a jet. So this plot, pulled from the CMS TDR, shows a correlation in phi, in the transverse plane, for QCD events with missing ET in them. So what's shown here is find a jet first, the biggest jet, that defines the axis. And then look at the direction of, look for some missing ET, and look at the correlation in phi between the missing ET and the jets, and the biggest jet. So this is what you get for pure QCD. This is a mismeasurement of the jet, sitting along the jet, I mismeasured it, so missing ET pointed in the same direction. And this is the opposite side from mismeasuring short, and the missing ET points backwards. This is what the same thing you get if you've just run some SUSY sample, and you make the same plot, find the ISP, G-jet, look at the correlation, and it's sort of trivial, it's obvious, because this missing ET comes from a SUSY cascade, that it's scattered all over the plot. But one of the important things you would do in trying to understand what's going on with missing ET, stay away from this dangerous region, where you're not really sure what's going on, but use these measurements to try to extrapolate what's going on here. That's a case where you would use the data itself, where there might be a signal here, rather than trying to use a Monte Carlo. Here's another easy one. This is another source of missing ET, if it's not detector mismeasurements, is neutrinos from Z decay. And then, of course, in principle at least, you've got a very trivial way to measure it. If you believe that you're dominated by missing ET from Z decays, you have Z to mu mu or Z to EE, which is measured in your detector, so you can measure the rate from this thing. You can remove the muons or the electrons and predict what the missing ET is. And if you believe from some Monte Carlo study that your missing ET is dominated by Z plus jets, you can validate that on the data itself by doing precisely this trick. I mean, it's trivial, but it's one of the things you will have to do. This is a guesstimate from Atlas, and this is supposed to demonstrate that, at least in the simulation, in these regions of very, very high missing ET, in events with jets and no leptons, that you are in fact dominated by Z decays. Now let's look at a slightly more complicated case. Let's look at a final state with leptons and jets. So never mind what this variable, here I've made a selection of events with the presence of electron and a bunch of jets. And then I'm plotting the missing ET distribution from that selected set of events. And what's shown on this plot, first of all, is some SUSY simulation. That's what this thing is here. That's not what I'm interested in at the moment. Some SUSY simulation here. I'm plotting both in missing ET and this effective mass variable, which Atlas often uses to parameterize new physics. And in this case, this thing is the scalar sum of this and the four highest PT jets in the event, and the lepton. So the events are selected by requiring that there be a bunch of jets, by requiring that there be a lepton, not requiring that there be any missing ET. So then you plot this thing, and you see this behavior. You run a Monte Carlo, and you try to estimate what sort of background you've got, and you get this plot. All this plot. Doesn't make any difference. So the first question is, if somebody showed this to you with real data, should you be booking a flight to Stockholm? And my answer is no. Because you first of all have to demonstrate that this is really here and not up there. Or worse, right down there. So there is no signal at all. So that's what I call validating the background calculation from the data itself. So in this case, if you look at these components in the background, what we believe the background is, we believe the background is dominated by things from that contain W's. TT bar, W plus jet, they're comparable out here. Those two dominate everything else. So you can ask yourself, can I prove that that's true? In other words, can I do a measurement which demonstrates that these components that I expect here are right? Well, if that's true, that the background has dominantly got a W in it. The missing ET, apart from detector mismeasurements, the missing ET in those events has to arise from the neutrino in the W decay. So I can form the normal transverse mass between that missing ET and the left. And I can ask, can I look at the distribution in that variable to prove that it's consistent with standard model or not? So here's a trivial plot to demonstrate that. So what's done with the Monte Carlo on the previous slide is to calculate the transverse mass between a lepton and the missing energy and divide it up into two regions, below 100 GeV and more than 100 GeV. And you see that from this that, not surprisingly, in the so-called background, which are top events in this case, that most of the top events are below 100 because there's a real W, that's this black line, and a smaller fraction are above it. Whereas if you were to do the same thing for a signal, you roughly get 1-to-1 here. So by fiddling around with this variable, you can change the signal to background ratio on the other plot. And if the other plot moves in the way that this does, I may have gotten the normalization completely screwed up. But nevertheless, it's probably all standard model. And that modeling has nothing to do with whether I actually got the number of jets right. So my Monte Carlo is complete nonsense. It doesn't predict the jet multiplicity, but it does at least say it's W's. So the way that you do this is you can use this transverse momentum, less than 100 GeV, to define a control region, and then stare at the missing ET plot and ask, is it true that if I look at this region, it's all background? I can also extrapolate from one region to another. If I play this game, I convince myself it is all background in some region, I can then normalize that point and move outwards. So this is what was done in simulation. Here's the SUSE signal again. Here's an estimate, assuming that this is all top, that's it, and using the region at the bottom to normalize it. This was the real Monte Carlo, and that was the estimate that you got by going through this procedure. Now, it's not quite right. Unfortunately, it's gone in the right direction, because it hasn't deluded you into believing there's a signal. This is just a trivial example of many others. Let me skip over the trivial. So now let me move to inclusive final states. So inclusive final states, you want to look at the behavior of these things as a function of the cut flow and ask, as you make more and more selective selections, is the variation in the event rate and the shape what you expect from signal or what you expect from background? It will be neither in general, because you will not have modeled the background correctly. So here's an example. This is just jets and ET miss, nothing else, which is the hardest final state to get right. It's much easier if you have leptons. So here's the first plot that you make. Again, I've plotted this effective mass variable with just a simple selection that there are a bunch of jets and missing ET. If you tighten the missing ET cap from this 100 GeV, then the signal starts to emerge. If you apply a bunch of topological cuts, essentially requiring the events to be more spherical, then you get this situation. So again, if it's doing what you expect in this cut flow from the modeling of your background, it's probably background. So I don't want to go through this in too much detail. In the lepton jet channel, it's usually much easier to control the background. Because, first of all, it's coming from top, W, which are intrinsically easier to model than a whole bunch of tails of QCD jets with nothing else present. It's also true that the reach in mass space is roughly the same in events with and without leptons. So I don't really gain much by not requiring a lepton. On the other hand, of course, it gives me much more confidence if I have a signal in this and I also have a signal in the other one. Then I'm more likely to believe one of them. If this has got a signal and the other one doesn't, we'll all be looking around saying, does your model have this feature? Okay. So again, this is the reach plot that CMS shows. This is M0 again, M1/2, for 10 inverse. Here's 1 inverse femtobarn. There's 10 inverse femtobands. So again, just to normalize this, this is sort of Gluino masses of 1.5 TeV. Things with structure are much easier to see. So for example, a dielectron may have a kinematic structure. electrons can come from independent decay chains, two different sides of the event. They can also come from a single decay chain, in which case there must be a kinematic constraint, because if everything comes from the decay of a single particle, there's a constraint among those objects. So what this shows is the invariant mass distribution of a dielectron pair from one of their simulations, and the background is dominated by TT bar at this point, because you need two isolated leptons and there isn't really much place to get anywhere else to get it from, and it's already pretty clean. But a flavour subtraction, because there has to be a correlation. These two have to be the same flavour if they're coming from a decay, whereas if it's TT bar, you can get mu from one side and E from the other. So this subtracted sort of plot, which you often see, is a very good way to clean up the background, provided that you carefully understand the relative acceptance and the relative efficiency for electrons and muons. Otherwise, you cannot make this plot. I'm not going to talk about tails. So here's the summary for the, from CMS of their inclusive searches. I'll flash the Atlas ones in a minute. And so they look in many final states. There are three jets and a muon, three jets and an opposite sign dielectron, a Higgs from a cascade decay, a Z, TT bar, that's harder, but you can do something. And you can see that these thin curves are all kind of contoural. And the important message of this is, if you don't, one inverse femtomon gets you somewhere around 1.4, 1.5, 1.6 TeV. Depends exactly whether you're here or not. If Susie hasn't shown up at this point, life's going to be tough. Because it means we're going to have to accumulate more luminosity in order to see something, and we're going to be sitting around for 10 years. We're not going to be having 10 years of fun trying to do it. Sorry? Wait a minute. This is the same sign, this is the opposite sign. Well, for some reason which I don't understand, and maybe a CMS person could answer this, there's a heavy focus in the CMS studies on lepton, on muon final states as opposed to electron final states. And many of their reach plots are shown for jets plus muons. Somebody wants to answer my question. To be honest, it doesn't make a lot of difference. A muon is, I mean, unless you're using it for triggering. Here's the, there's usually a political answer for these things. Here's the reach limits for Atlas shown in SUGRO, which is basically the same as CMS, that's the one up on the left, and also shown in the two other canonical models. Can you give me another minute? So if you move to exclusive analyses, the goal here is to reconstruct decay chains and possibly disentangle a model. Now, I think you have to draw a distinction here between trying to understand what the underlying model is and trying to measure masses. You can do one without the other. So if you can identify a characteristic decay chain, you might be able to measure something about the masses in that decay chain and still be completely clueless about what the underlying model is. So I think it's very important. This isn't the same as fitting to a model. And I've got a slide on that, which I won't get to. Okay. So one of the biggest problems you have here is combinatorics. That is to say, when you have lots of jets, lots of leptons in the event, you always have a combinatorial problem. So in most of the analyses, CMS apply this hemisphere method, where they look for the highest jet in the event, they look for the second highest jet in the event, and they group things up to divide the event in two. And then when they do combinatorics, they look for the particles only in one side of the event. And all I can do here is to just flash one plot to show you the power of this method. This is the case where there's a Higgs in the supersymmetric cascade decay, and the Higgs decays to BB bar. If you took all Bs in the event, this is what you would get. If you only pick the pair which are assigned to the same hemisphere by this hemisphere method, then you get this thing. So this is somewhat cleaner than that. It's just an idea which will drive all these exclusive final states. You will have to do something to get rid of the combinatorics. Atlas does all this for picking out the highest PT object and then trying to assign it that way. So here's a typical decay chain and the stuff you would like to extract. So here's a gluino decaying into a squark and a quark, squark decaying into an electroweak gauge boson, partner of a gauge boson, and another quark. Here's a selectron, here's an electron, here's an electron, here's an OSP. So you'd like to reconstruct this whole mesh, and you'd like from this to measure the mass of this, 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 and this. Of course, that's not trivial, particularly since the event's full of all other rubbish which doesn't come from this, the combinatorial problem that I just alluded to when I showed you the CMS thing. The dielectron thing I already showed you gives you this characteristic endpoint, so I won't show that anymore. If you can put the lepton together with one of these jets, then there is a kinematic structure, if you can find the right jet. If you can't find the right jet, of course, there is no kinematic structure. And if you work this through, there's the invariant mass of these three objects has a minimum and maximum value. So if you can correctly assign these, you can get two numbers out of it. And this is an Atmos simulation showing the maximum value and the minimum value. There's a turn on here for a couple of different cases. You can also put together one lepton and a bunch of jets to give you another piece of information, and that's another example. And all these plots have a zero here because they're all subtracted using the dielectron subtraction measure that I alluded to earlier in order to clean up the background. It's very, very important. Now, if you don't do that, the plots become much dirtier and you get stuff going out beyond this tail. So here's some guesstimate of what you might get for the precision in these endpoints. And so the normalization here, it's one inverse femtobarn for one of the cases studied and half an inverse femtobarn for the other case studied. And so the precision, here's the truth, here's what they got from the fit, and the errors are more important, and you've rapidly become dominated. So the errors are statistics, systematics, and general, and the jet energy scale separated out, which tends to dominate the things like the dielectron plus jet things. So the reason, fortuitously perhaps, that for these particular cases that were studied, which correspond to a squark mass of 650 JeV in this case, that the statistics error is still larger than the systematics, but you don't have to wait much longer before that's not the case. And in order to do real precision measurements, you have to start worrying about this. You can also add the squark right from this transverse mass distribution. You could try to put Higgs's together. This is a joke, so let's have it. There's much theoretical angst about this kind of thing. You know, here's some mass spectra in supersymmetric models. In fact, I think this is one of your plots. I couldn't remember, so I didn't put anybody's. This is one of my plots, but I think this is one of your plots. Here's a mass spectrum in an extra dimensions model, and there's much angst about, well, this sort of looks like one of these, and this looks like this, or this looks like this, particularly if you can only see this piece. This is a problem I'd like to have. I don't have anything else to say about it. If this was my only problem, I would be delighted. Okay, now let's talk about measuring parameters. If you're old enough like me and Gordy, then you can remember in the early days of electroweak theory, people didn't fit the standard model. They didn't fit the parameters that we now think of, the Weinberg angle and G Fermi or whatever you want to think the fundamental parameters are. They used to fit general four Fermi interactions. They didn't even fit V minus A. They fit V and A with a different number, and sometimes they also fit scalar couplings and all kinds of other things. So this gives you a huge number of parameters, many, many more than we have in the standard model. Nobody bothers with any of this junk anymore. And the reason that nobody bothers with any of this junk is it fits perfectly with the standard model, so why bother? Before you had the standard model and you were convinced that the standard model existed, you had to go through this. So although people don't like it when you talk about fitting models, in practice that will tend to happen. People will fit a model, if it doesn't work, they'll bin the model and try to fit something else. And that's what I said, remember, Mr. Ockham. You know, don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. Keep it simple. The other comment I've got about parameters is using rates is a very important tool. But if you don't have a model, it's extremely difficult because you have one or two numbers. I mean, you can have rates for different processes. And what you have is a combination of a production rate and a decay rate. And you may not understand either of them in general. You may not know what the hell is coming out. So if you've got a model and you predict some rates and you get it right, it's an incredibly powerful check of the model, assuming you can model it properly in your experiment. But if you don't have a model, rates, we don't really know what to do with rates. But I can tell if they're off by factors of 100. But if they're off by factors of 2 or 3, I don't really know what to do with them. And so this is an extremely powerful model test once you have a model. And it's something, rates are things that people right now don't include. Neither the Atlas nor the CMS teams. So let me just wrap up. So we'll have first collisions in the next month or two. As Leandro said, we'll be at 10 TeV this year. This is vital to get the shakedown of the detectors. We don't know what the integrated luminosity will be. I'm not even willing to guess. To be honest, it doesn't matter all that much, provided it's not zero. There will be an extension during which the detectors will surely need to fix the problems that they've uncovered this year, and perhaps the complete installations of things that didn't actually make it. There will, the 2009 run, which will probably start around about March or April, I would guess, of 2009, we should get 1 to 2 inverse femtobands, according to the machine people. It probably will be at 14 TeV. There's no real reason for to continue to run at the lower energy. If SUSE is right, based on the numbers that I showed you, you should look for a discovery sort of 2 years from now. Assuming that we haven't had a disaster, we've got some integrated luminosity, the detectors have understood. If you haven't seen it by then, you're going to have to wait a while, because it's going to be the same sort of game we currently have at the Tevatron, where, yes, you run a bit longer, the reach goes up, but the big thing's over already. The full step to the 10 to the 34 luminosity is 7 years away. That will give you another sort of jump. After this year, I think we'll have a clearer idea about what's going on. I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, I'm done.
Questions, comments?
Yes, Jeff.
So you said that many backgrounds, for many of the backgrounds, you would want to determine them from data and not rely on the Monte Carlo. My question is, are there any backgrounds that you would rely on the Monte Carlo for?
Well, I
unless
think
except for backgrounds that are negligible.
The simple answer is no. But you always will need to use, the simple answer is no, because you always want to have absolute confidence of what's going on. But you will always, in many cases, have to extrapolate. So you will have some plot, and over on the left, I've measured the background, and I agree perfectly. Now I'm only using the Monte Carlo to extrapolate a little bit. And that's probably okay. A good example that people might remember is in the early days of the top measurement at CDF, which I guess you did, right? No, you won't know. Was that the, one of the arguments for whether or not there was a signal was based on jet counting in events with a W. So you find a W first, and then you look at the jet multiplicity. And you expect that the top signal from TT bar emerges as an excess in high numbers of jets. Now, nobody has it much confidence in the prediction of QCD rates for multi-jets. But now we do, but back then nobody did. So, of course, what you did was to look at the 1 and 2 jet final states and 3 jet final states where you didn't expect to see a signal, and then you use it to extrapolate. So that's not the same thing as saying I've only calculated the 3 jets and I'm using that. I think anybody who says, here's the plot, I've only calculated this, I'm going to tell them to go away. Leandro.
Very quickly, just to add to what Ian said, I don't know any, I'm not aware of any physics process that will be using Monte Carlo predictions.
Right, that's a clearer way of putting it. No, that's a clearer way of putting it. Except as you said, sorry Jeff, as you said, there are some cases where you think the background is 10 to the minus 6. There I might rely on a Monte Carlo.
Okay, if no more questions, let's thank you again.
Well, that's their machine. I can leave it there.